Dance Celebration supports WHYY and presents the dancer athletes of Pilobolis and their gravity-defying, rule-breaking choreography. Seen previously at the Oscars and the Olympics, Pilobolis returns to Philadelphia with new works. Pilobolis, May 7th through 10th at the Annenberg Center. Details at 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org. 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org.
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, we'll consider what the absence of black men from their community says about America's criminal justice system. First, Camden County is the 12th largest municipality in New Jersey. Last year, it ranked first for complaints of police excessive force. The Philadelphia Inquirer arrived at that number by analyzing police records. Details from WHYY's Bobby Allen.
Officers in Camden have taken community policing to an extreme. They've read books to kindergarten kids, and they've given out free ice cream in an effort to build good relations with residents. But one statistic flies in the face of the upbeat news. Last year, there were 65 complaints of police using excessive force.
We know we're going to do better.
County spokesman Dan Keeshan says the 65 complaints need some context.
We've also had 245 officers assaulted over that period of time. We've had almost 4,000 calls for a male with a gun in which officers went out and made 500 arrests to take illegal guns off the street.
Keeshan says more complaints come as the department grows. The last time the force was as big as it is now, in 2004, there were more than 100 complaints.
Well, to me, it sounds like it's a race to the bottom. And the question is, is the Camden Police Department as bad as it used to be? And that's not the right question.
Udi Ofer is the executive director of New Jersey's ACLU. Ofer says he's concerned that the department didn't substantiate any of the excessive force complaints from last year. He urges the department to open up its books and explain why. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments tomorrow in a case that could determine how same-sex marriage is viewed on a national stage. One of the plaintiffs is a Delaware man whose husband died while living in Ohio. WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports.
David Michener officially married Bill Ives in Delaware in the summer of 2013, 14 years after their commitment ceremony in 1999.
This is the two of us at Holly Hedge in New Hope. It was a very beautiful day.
Flipping through the pages of a photo album in the Lewis home he shared with Bill, David remembers better times.
To live it over again.
Although they lived in Ohio, David and Bill spent summers in Delaware with their three adopted children, Anna, Jack, and Michael. They were planning to retire here for good in the near future. But just weeks after their 2013 wedding, Bill got sick.
They found that the bacteria really was eating the right side of his heart. And they put him on life support after 18 hours. 3 days later, he died.
As sudden as his husband's death was, Michener was in for another shock. While preparing for Ives' wake, he was told there was a problem with the death certificate.
Because Ohio does not recognize same-sex marriage, they're trying to get my name off the death certificate. I was shocked.
After fighting to keep his name on Ives' death certificate in Ohio courts, Michener is now part of a broader case that will be heard in the U.S. Supreme Court. The case centers on the rights of married couples living in states where same-sex marriage is not recognized.
It's an insult that extends beyond death.
That's Steve Shapiro, National Legal Director for the ACLU.
It is the state saying, in perpetuity, right, we don't recognize what you and your partner had.
After an initial court victory for Michener, one Ohio state lawmaker called for impeaching the judge who ruled in his favor. Republican Representative John Becker issued a statement calling the ruling an epic display of arrogance and incompetence. He claimed the ruling from Judge Timothy Black, who was appointed by President Obama, violated Ohio's state rights. The federal government has an ever-growing propensity to violate state sovereignty, Becker said in the statement. Michener says everyone doesn't have to agree, but that shouldn't change his rights under the law.
My opinion on things may not be the same as somebody else's, but that doesn't give him the right to make somebody feel like a second-class citizen.
After a long struggle in Delaware, same-sex couples have been gaining recognition and rights rather suddenly. The state's first civil union ceremonies were performed in January 2012, the first legal gay weddings in July 2013. Earlier this year, Holly and Casey Clark Porter became what's believed to be the first lesbian couple to be ordained as Presbyterian ministers. They talked about Michener's case at First and Central Presbyterian Church in Wilmington.
I think this is why we're continuing to fight.
That's Holly Clark Porter.
I think that some people think that this fight is over, that we gays just need to shut up already, that we've gotten our way, and this just proves that we haven't and that there is work to do.
For David Michener, the case is about honoring Bill's life.
It's for him and my kids and for everyone out in Ohio and the other states that don't have equal rights.
The Supreme Court decision should be issued in June. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
What does it take to lead a city with 1.4 million residents? Six Democrats running for mayor of Philadelphia fielded that question this morning at our studios in a debate co-sponsored by WHYY, the Committee of 70, the Philadelphia Business Journal, and the group Young Involve Philadelphia. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that the exchange brought out some conversation about leadership, as well as sharp exchanges about who's funding the campaigns.
The questions focused less on what candidates promised to do about key issues than what they've done or learned in their careers that will make them effective mayors. The following excerpts from the exchanges are slightly edited for time. Former City Councilman Jim Kenney said Ed Rendell was effective as mayor, in part because his staff paid attention to the individuals on City Council.
And their relationship with me made a difference. And I think that what you need to do is continue to understand what council members think are important. I think to enhance their ability to get the things that are important to them done, and then when you need to go back to them for a PGW, for a heart issue, they're there for you because you've been there for them. And I think that's what it's all about, good relationships with people.
Asked for examples of when she managed to achieve change, Lynn Abraham recalled her efforts as district attorney to get the criminal justice system to address women's issues, including domestic violence, sexual assault, and child support.
We held the destiny of 125,000 families in our hands trying to get women and their children to get adequate child support payments. I believe that the hardest part was to convince all the players in the Philadelphia government, the police department, and elsewhere, to make sure that the interests of women and children were taken care of.
As usual, the most entertaining participant was former State Senator Milton Street. He flatly declined to talk about his conviction for failing to file tax returns and said he never had a problem saying things he didn't mean to. When asked how he would upgrade the city's information technology, Street said he'd get good people. Then his cell phone rang.
You know, you can't have a mayor or president of the United States who's going to know every department. So what you do is you reach out in the community and you find the best people. This is the president of the United States. Okay, keeps calling. You can't keep reaching out into the... I thought I had turned this off, so that tells you what I know about technology, right?
Asked for a big idea his administration would implement, State Senator Anthony Williams said he'd revisit the idea of selling the city-owned gas utility, PGW, and use the proceeds to shore up the ailing pension system.
If we close the pension problem we have in Philadelphia by drawing down the billions of dollars for that opportunity, then the increasing amount that's going towards that pension responsibility goes towards schools. And Philadelphia can do it without raising taxes. At the same time, creating thousands of jobs in Philadelphia. An energy hub that all of the candidates are talking about will be realized within 4 years.
Doug Oliver, who used to work for PGW, is the youngest and least known of the candidates. He was asked for a quote that inspires him.
And that is, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting something different. If you want something different, you've got to do something different. Do, D-O. Doug Allen.
Former Judge Nelson Diaz said he's shown leadership in a variety of roles in his career.
I've been involved for over 45 years in trying to make this city better, whether it was in civil rights, economic development, economic opportunity, or even serving on a corporate board, making sure we have social responsibility in terms of minority contracting and minority opportunities.
The sharpest exchanges came between Kenny and Williams, the two candidates benefiting from TV ad campaigns funded by super PACs. Williams took issue with the support Kenny gets from Electricians Union leader John Dougherty.
Jimmy Kenny said he wasn't going to run because he didn't have the money. That's why he didn't run. Then, literally, 3 months in the process, he decides to run because John Dockery says we'll take care of it. That's the bottom line, and that's the truth.
Kenny came back with a reference to three wealthy pro-school choice financial executives that are putting millions into a super PAC backing Williams.
Contrary to recent assertions, I did not get in this race at the behest of one labor leader. I got in this race to support and help working families in our city. I certainly did not get in this race to promote the agenda of three hedge fund billionaires who want to privatize our education system.
You can hear the entire debate tonight at 9 on WHYY-FM, or you can watch it on demand at newsworks.org. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
In other news today, Pennsylvania's highest court finds the child endangerment conviction of a Roman Catholic Church official in Philadelphia was wrongly overturned. The state Supreme Court ruling upholds the 2012 conviction of Monsignor William Lynn over abuse committed by a diocesan priest years earlier. He has served half his 3 to 6 year sentence, but has been on house arrest since the Superior Court threw out his conviction in 2013. It now goes back to a lower court, though Lynn's attorney could appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The new owner of Atlantic City's former Revel Casino hits a roadblock in reopening. New Jersey's Gaming Enforcement Division finds Glenn Straub's Polo North Country Club cannot simply assume Revel's casino license in bankruptcy court. Regulators say he needs to be approved for his own license to operate a casino, adding he's not currently authorized to possess gambling equipment, including the slot machines still inside the building. 57 degrees, partly cloudy on Independence Mall. It's 617. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Anticipate clearing skies overnight, low 47 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. Tuesday's high, 68. Still ahead, we'll bust out the freeze-dried ice cream to celebrate the anniversary of the first tourist in outer space.
Oh, it was first class all the way. He got all the best seats and all the best views. I'm not so sure about the food.
Newsworks Tonight spoons out a double scoop on WHYY.
Everyone is looking for something. Consistency, quality, peace of mind. Haverford Trust Company, quality investing, and a proud supporter of WHYY.
People's Light presents Biloxi Blues, April 29th to May 24th. This semi-autobiographical Tony Award-winning play by American comedic genius Neil Simon follows the adventures of Eugene Morris Jerome as he is shipped off to boot camp during World War II. A classic coming-of-age tale told with wit, heart, and humor. For tickets, peopleslight.org or 610-644-3500. People's Light supports WHYY.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
The makers of World's Best Cat Litter support WHYY, offering a family of cat litters made from concentrated, naturally absorbent corn. World's Best Cat Litter can help maintain a cleaner litter box. Online at discoverworldsbest.com.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Let's encounter a sure sign along the way to summer season. Joining me with a 2015 May Day alert, Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. May Day celebrations go way, way back in history.
Yes, indeed they do. May Day is also a day known as Beltane if you are an aficionado of Gaelic festivals. This particular day that we identify, the first day of May, May Day, turns out to be a celebration held by a lot of Northern Hemisphere cultures of some time ago, hundreds of years ago, maybe even 1,000 years ago or more. But in particular, this one, known as Beltane or Bealtaine, really is a Gaelic May Day festival. It's typically held April 30th or May 1st. And what it's meant to do is to really welcome the coming of spring.
But indeed, it's not the advent of spring, rather the cross-quarter day halfway between the start of spring and start of summer on the calendar.
Yeah, that's true. It is that cross-quarter day halfway between the first day of spring and first day of summer as we define it. But some of these older cultures of Northern Europe actually identified this day as the first day of summer. For example, Shakespeare's play, A Midsummer Night's Dream, well, that doesn't take place in July or August. That really takes place in June. And so that's how it comes to be midsummer for that play, because the beginning of summer was identified at May Day rather than June 21st.
Well, before bidding adieu to April, there are apparently several space firsts to note on that month.
You know, the original seven American astronauts were chosen in 1959 in April. The first human in space, Yuri Gagarin, a Russian, his flight was 54 years ago in 1961. The first test firing of the Saturn V launch vehicle that actually carried Americans to the moon, that first test firing was in 1965, 50 years ago. Such a powerful machine, it's hard to imagine that it took place back then in what now seems like the Dark Ages. The first spacecraft to orbit the moon, Luna 10, was launched in 1966. The first space station, Salyut 1, again, a Russian spacecraft, was in 1971. The first space funeral took place in 1997. And this was actually an instance in which a number of very small capsules of the ashes of a number of deceased were actually launched into space.
I'm curious, has that event been replicated since?
Yes, indeed it has, and there are two notable internments, if you will, in space. One is Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, and also Eugene Shoemaker. Eugene Shoemaker was an American geologist who was the person who taught all of the Apollo astronauts how to do geology on the moon. And one final major milestone of April is that the first space tourist, Dennis Tito, a private citizen, visited the Mir space station in 2001. Now, Mir space station, as I mentioned earlier, was a Russian space station, actually, a Soviet space station. And the way that Dennis Tito got to go was that he offered to pay for his trip. And at that time, the Russians were accepting payment for private citizens to visit the Mir space station. And I believe Mr. Tito paid somewhere upwards of $20 million to make the trip.
Was that first class or coach?
Oh, it was first class all the way. He got all the best seats and all the best views. I'm not so sure about the food.
I'm thinking Russian caviar and champagne.
Probably vodka instead, but we'll have to check the stores and see what's still up there.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
If you find Earth boring, just the same old, same.
Statistics. They're comprised of hard numbers, though there are often many ways to interpret them. When a report was released regarding the large number of black men missing from their communities, NewsWorks blogger Solomon Jones saw it as a chance to shed light on lives lived in the face of implicit bias.
The New York Times recently reported that there are 1.5 million black men between the ages of 25 and 54 missing from their communities due to incarceration or early death. In fact, for every 100 black women between the ages of 25 and 54 who are not in jail, the report says, there are only 83 black men. What does their absence mean? It means that some parts of our community have been left without husbands or fathers, without sons or uncles, without providers or protectors. And if the report is to be believed, the absence of those men has left us without hope. Fortunately, I don't carve my reality from the rough-hewn stone of statistics. Statistics, after all, can be shaped to support whatever point of view one wants them to represent. So what do I believe? I believe that the mass incarceration of black men has many causes, including the inescapable reality of personal responsibility. But there is another reality as well, and it is laid out in the Sentencing Project's report on sentencing disparities to the United Nations. Racial minorities are more likely than whites to be arrested. Once arrested, they are more likely to be convicted. And once convicted, they are more likely to face stiff sentences, the report reads. It goes on to describe an even harsher reality. Black men are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than white men, and 2.5 times more likely than Hispanic men. According to the Sentencing Project's report, America operates two distinct criminal justice systems, one for wealthy people and another for poor people and minorities. On the surface, the system is colorblind, but underneath, the report says, it is driven by implicit bias, the belief that blacks are inherently criminal, violent, and dangerous. That bias has created a reality in which blacks are three times more likely to be searched during traffic stops than white drivers, and twice as likely to experience the use or threat of violent force at the hands of police. Does that pressure explain why homicide is the number one cause of death among black men between the ages of 25 and 34? Not completely, but it might help explain why heart disease is the top killer among black men between the ages of 35 and 54. When the biases of others cause you to be arrested more readily, punished more harshly, and killed more quickly, you never know how much time you have left. Perhaps that's what causes black men to spend more time with their children than men of other races. That's according to a study by the Centers for Disease Control. And perhaps it should make those of us who remain in our communities more committed to making a difference. If we can't do at least that much, we might as well be invisible too. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog for Newsworks.org. Two trees made of polished steel were installed last year along the Parkway in Philadelphia, intended as a temporary addition to the city's public sculpture collection. From WHYY's Arts and Culture desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the sculpture is now permanent.
The sculpture, called Symbiosis, is one life-sized steel tree fallen into the branches of another. And that could be a symbol for relationships, or for politics, or the environment, really almost anything you want. Viewers can now spend as much time as they like musing on its meaning. The Association for Public Art raised an undisclosed amount of money from a single donor, the Daniel Dietrich Trust, to keep the sculpture rooted to the parkway. Association Director Penny Balkenbach says the work has beguiled viewers since it was introduced.
The work really was just endlessly engaging. On a certain level, very ambiguous. It doesn't tell you everything about itself.
The artist Roxy Payne has had other pieces installed in prominent places like the National Gallery in Washington and New York's Central Park. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas with help today from Brett Rader. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Penn Museum supports WHYY. In 1940, Penn Museum excavated objects from the burial site of an ancient Panamanian chief, unearthing golden plaques, precious stones, painted ceramics, and more. In Beneath the Surface, Life, Death, and Gold in Ancient Panama, open now at the Penn Museum. Learn the story behind the excavation, the artifacts uncovered, and the mysterious Coclay people who lived, died, and buried their dead more than 1,000 years ago. Details at penn.museum.
Support for WHYY comes from the Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, announcing its 2015-16 season at the Kimmel Center with CNN Chief Medical Correspondent Sanjay Gupta, Captain Mark Kelly, and former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, rights activist Ayan Hirsi Ali, futurist Michio Kaku, renowned American diplomat Dennis Ross, record-setting swimmer Diana Nyad, and former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta. More information online at philadelphiaspeakerseries.org, sponsored by the Haverford Trust Company.